2 days after the King Memorial, Grayson Kirk went to the University of Virginia to deliver a speech on the occasion of Thomas Jefferson's 225th birthday. Tempestuous as those days might have been, they were also thick with absurdities. And there, the former political scientist, who sat on the boards of several corporations and financial institutions, Mobil Oil, IBM, and Con Edison among them, the president of Columbia University, who had succeeded Dwight D. Eisenhower after the general left Columbia to become president of the United States, there for the first time, Grayson Kirk came out against the war in Vietnam. Not because the war was wrong or less than honorable, he said, but because of the damage it was doing at home. And then he uttered the sentences that would soon find their way back to the Columbia campus and add another dose of gasoline to the fire that was already starting to burn there. Quote, "Our young people, in disturbing numbers, appear to reject all forms of authority, from whatever source derived, and they have taken refuge in a turbulent and inchoate nihilism whose sole objectives are destruction. I know of no time in our history when the gap between the generations has been wider or more potentially dangerous." On April 22nd, the day the IDA-6 were put on probation, SDS published a one-off four-page newspaper entitled Up Against the Wall, in advance of the rally scheduled for noon the next day, which was supposed to culminate in another indoor demonstration at Lowe Library, where dozens or scores or hundreds would show their support for the IDA-6 by breaking the same rule that had gotten the 6 into trouble. One of the articles was written by Rudd, an 850-word letter addressed to Grayson Kirk in response to the remarks he had made at the University of Virginia. It ended with the following 3 short paragraphs. "Grayson, I doubt if you will understand any of this, since your fantasies have shut out the world as it really is from your thinking. Vice President Truman says the society is basically sound. You say the war in Vietnam was a well-intentioned accident. We, the young people, whom you so rightly fear, say that the society is sick and you and your capitalism are the sickness. You call for order and respect for authority. We call for justice, freedom, and socialism. There's only one thing left to say. It may sound nihilistic to you, since it is the opening shot in a war of liberation. I'll use the words of Leroy Jones, whom I'm sure you don't like a whole lot. Up against the wall, motherfucker. This is a stick-up." Ferguson was appalled. After the eloquent speech Rudd had given at the King Memorial, it made no sense that he should commit such a bad tactical blunder. That wasn't to say the substance of the text lacked merit, but the tone was obnoxious, and if SDS was trying to increase its support among the students, this kind of thing would only push them away. The article was an example of SDS talking to itself rather than reaching out to others, and Ferguson wanted SDS to win. For notwithstanding certain reservations about what was possible and not possible, he mostly stood behind the group and believed in its cause. But a noble cause demanded noble behavior from its advocates, something finer and more self-controlled than run-of-the-mill insults and cheap adolescent shots. The pity of it was that Ferguson liked Mark Rudd. They had been friends since their freshman year, fellow New Jersey boys with almost identical backgrounds, and Mark had been impressive as chairman so far, so impressive that Ferguson had been blinded into thinking he could never make any mistakes, and now that he had slipped up with this dear Grayson and motherfucker business, Ferguson was feeling let down, stranded in the awkward position of being against the ones who were against, which was a lonely place to be for a person who was also against the ones who were for. Remarkably enough, Amy did not disagree with him. They were still in the midst of their two-bed cooling-off period and hadn't seen much of each other in the past several days. But when Amy came home from her SDS meeting on the night of the 22nd, she too was feeling let down, not just because of the article, which she admitted was both crude and childish, but because only 50 to 60 people had come to Fairweather Hall for the last meeting of the school year, whereas most of the gatherings in the past months had drawn 200 or more. and she was afraid that SDS was losing ground, that nearly every inch of the ground it had won had now been lost, and tomorrow was going to be a disaster, she said, a feeble last stand that would end in failure and shut down SDS at Columbia for good. She was wrong. Spring 1968, 3. Never before in the annals of, never before so much as thought. The widening gyre, and all at once everything turning within it. Nobadaddy doubled over with stomach cramps, the shits, Hotspur hopping, a shape with lion body and the head of a man, a horde. How who what, and all suddenly asking him, why darkness and obscurity and all thy words and laws? The center could not, the things could not, the horde could not do other than it did. But anarchy was not loose. It was the world that loosened, at least for a time, and thus began the largest, most sustained student protest in American history. Close to 1,000 on the morning of. Two-thirds aunties gathered around the sundial in the center of the campus, one-third anti-aunties standing on the steps of Lowe, presumably to protect the building from assault, but also to smash and bash if it came to that. They had already published warnings, and the threat of fisticuffs had brought out a platoon of young professors prepared to break things up if necessary. Speeches to begin with, one by one the usual stuff, the SDS line, but SAS was there as well, the first integrated political rally at Columbia ever. And when Cicero Wilson mounted the sundial to address the crowd, the newly elected president of SAS began by talking about Harlem and the gym. But moments later, Ferguson was shocked. He was attacking the white students. If you want to know who they're talking about, he said, meaning racist, you go look in the mirror because you know nothing about black people. Amy, who was standing in front, interrupted him and called out, what makes you think there aren't white people on your side? What makes you think we aren't all in this together? We're your brothers and sisters, pal, and we'll be a hell of a lot stronger if you stand with us when we stand with you. A bad beginning. Hats off to Amy for having spoken up, but a rocky start. And the confusion continued for some time. Lowe was impregnable. The doors had been locked, and no one was willing to break them down or start a fight with the security guards. Back to the sundial, which was adorned with an inscription that read, Horum Expecta Veniet. Await the hour, it shall come. But had the hour really come? Or was April 23rd collapsing into yet one more missed opportunity? Another round of speeches, but everything had come to a standstill, and the energy of the crowd had evaporated. Just when it seemed that the rally was fizzling to its conclusion, however, someone yelled out, "To the gym site!" The words struck with the force of a slap to the face, and suddenly 300 students were running east down College Walk to Morningside Park. Amy had underestimated the magnitude of the discontent, the epidemic of unhappiness that had spread through the ranks of the non-SDS majority on campus, most of whom seemed headed for nervous breakdowns as the unwinnable war thundered on and the nobodaddies in the White House and Lowe Library kept speaking their dark words and issuing their obscure laws. And as Ferguson ran alongside the crowd that was running to the park, he understood that the students were possessed, that their souls had been taken over by the same fusion of anger and joy he had witnessed in the streets of Newark last summer. And as long as no bullets were fired, such a crowd could not be controlled. There were policemen in the park, but not enough of them to stop a gang of students from tearing down 40 feet of the chain-link fence that surrounded the construction site as other students tussled with the outmanned guards. And there was David Zimmer, Ferguson noted, and there was Zimmer's friend Marco Fogg. Gentle Zimmer and even more gentle Fogg were in the gang attacking the fence, and for a moment Ferguson envied them, wishing he could join in and do what they were doing. But then the feeling passed, and he held his ground. Almost a battle, but not quite. Skirmishes, flare-ups, shoving matches, cops against students, students against cops, students jumping cops, students kicking cops, pushing them into the dirt. One Columbia boy hauled off in the middle of it, white, non-SDS, charged with felonious assault, criminal mischief, and resisting arrest. When more cops began descending into the park with their billy clubs out, the students left the site and headed back toward the campus. Meanwhile, the other crowd of students, the ones who had stayed behind, were now marching toward the park. The advancing group and the retreating group met in the middle on Morningside Drive, and when the retreaters told the advancers that their business in the park was done, both groups walked back to the campus and reassembled at the sundial. There were about 500 of them at that point, and no one knew what was going to happen next. An hour and a half ago, there had been a plan, but events had overpowered that plan, and whatever happened next would have to be improvised. As far as Ferguson could tell, only one fact was clear. The crowd was still possessed and ready to do just about anything. A few minutes later, most of them were on their way to Hamilton Hall, where hundreds spilled into the lobby on the ground floor, a mass of bodies crammed into that small space as jocks jostled and pukes pushed back and more bodies poured in. Everyone charged up and confused. So confused that the first act of the campus rebellion was the misguided, self-defeating error of locking the undergraduate dean in his office and holding him hostage, a mistake that was rectified the next afternoon when Henry Coleman was released. But still, the students involved in the takeover of the building had the wherewithal to form a steering committee composed of 3 members from SDS, 3 from SAS, 2 from the College Citizenship Council, and 1 unaffiliated sympathizer, and come up with a list of demands that set forth the aims of the protest. 1. All disciplinary action now pending and probations already imposed upon 6 students to be immediately terminated and a general amnesty granted to those students participating in this demonstration. 2. President Kirk's ban on demonstrations inside university buildings to be dropped. 3. Construction of the Columbia Gymnasium in Morningside Park ceased at once. 4. All future disciplinary action taken against university students be resolved through an open hearing before students and faculty, which adheres to the standards of due process. 5. Columbia University disaffiliate, in fact and not merely on paper, with the Institute for Defense Analyses, and President Kirk and Trustee William A. M. Burden resign their positions on IDA's Board of Trustees and Executive Board. 6. Columbia University use its good offices to obtain dismissal of charges now pending against those participating in demonstrations at the gym construction site in the park. The doors of the building remained open. It was early afternoon on a normal school day, and as Rudd later told Ferguson, the SDS contingent felt they couldn't afford to alienate the non-participating students by blocking their access to classes, which were still being held on the upper floors. They wanted to win the students over to their side, and it wouldn't have made sense to do something that would have turned the majority against them. The building wasn't occupied at that point, then. There was a sit-in taking place within the building, and as the day advanced and word got out about what was going on at Hamilton Hall, dozens of people who were not connected to the university began turning up. SDSers from other colleges, members of SNCC and CORE, representatives from various Peace Now organizations. And as those people arrived to lend their support, in came food, blankets, and other practical necessities for the people who would be spending the night in the building. Amy was one of those people, but Ferguson was busy taking notes and had no time to talk to her. He blew her a kiss instead. She smiled and waved back, one of the rare smiles she had given him in the past several weeks, and then he dashed off to the Spectator office in Ferris Booth Hall to write his article. That night, the frail, short-lived alliance between SDS and SAS fell apart. The black students wanted to barricade the doors and shut everyone out of Hamilton until the 6 demands had been met. They were ready to make a stand, they said, and with talk circulating in the halls that guns had been smuggled into the building, the implication was that the stand they were talking about could be a violent one. It was 5 o'clock in the morning at that point, and hours of discussion had led to an impasse, the open-door, closed-door dispute could not be resolved, and now SAS was politely suggesting that SDS leave the building and occupy a building of its own. Ferguson understood the SAS position, but at the same time he found the split depressing and demoralizing, and he understood why SDS should have felt so hurt by the divorce. It was Aranda Williams saying no all over again. It was his father saying all those repulsive things after the Newark riots. It was what the world had come to. The irony was that without the SDS expulsion that morning, the rebellion at Columbia never would have spread beyond Hamilton Hall, and the story of the next 6 weeks would have been a different story, a much smaller story, and the big thing that eventually happened would not have been big enough for anyone to notice it. In the minutes before dawn on April 24th, the banished SDSers broke into Low Library and barricaded themselves inside President Kirk's suite of offices. 16 hours later, 100 students from the School of Architecture took control of Avery Hall. 4 hours after that, at 2 a.m. on the morning of the 25th, 200 graduate students locked themselves inside Fairweather Hall. At 1 o'clock in the morning on the 26th, a spillover group from Low Library took over Mathematics Hall, and within hours, 200 students and non-student radicals were in charge of a fifth building. That same night, Columbia announced that it was acceding to Mayor Lindsay's request to suspend construction of the gym. The university had shut down, and there was no activity on campus anymore that was not political activity. Low Library, Avery Hall, Fairweather Hall, and Mathematics Hall were no longer a library and three halls, but four communes. Hamilton Hall had been renamed Malcolm X University. Nobodaddy's children were saying no, but still no one knew what was going to happen next. Ferguson was scrambling. The five-day-a-week paper had become a seven-day-a-week paper, and there were articles to write, places to go to, people to talk to, meetings to attend, and all on little or no sleep, barely more than 2 or 3 hours a night, and all on little or no food but rolls, salami sandwiches, and coffee and 1,000 cigarettes. But the scrambling was good for him, he realized. To be so busy and so exhausted had the double effect of keeping him awake and numb at the same time, and he needed to be awake in order to see the things that were happening around him and write about those events with the quickness and accuracy they demanded, and he needed to be numb in order not to think about Amy, who was all but lost to him now, all but gone, and even though he kept telling himself he would fight to win her back, do everything he could to prevent the unthinkable from happening, he knew that whatever they had been to each other in the past was not what they were now. She was with the group in Low, one of the diehards. On the afternoon of the 26th, as Ferguson was rushing across the campus on his way to Mathematics Hall, he caught sight of her standing on the second floor ledge just outside the window of Kirk's office. Standing to her right was Les Gottesman, who was no longer in the college but a student in the graduate English department. And standing to her left was Hilton Obenzinger, Les's good friend, who was also Ferguson's friend, one of the stalwarts of the Columbia Review. And there was Amy standing between Les and Hilton with the sun shining down on her, a sun so strong that her impossible hair seemed ablaze in the afternoon light, and she looked happy, Ferguson thought, so damned happy that he wanted to weep. Spring, 1968, 4. What he was watching was a revolution in miniature, Ferguson decided, a revolution in a dollhouse. SDS's objective was to force a showdown with Columbia that would reveal the administration to be exactly what the group claimed it was, intransigent, out of touch with reality, a small piece in the large American picture of racism and imperialism. And once SDS had proved that to the rest of the students on campus, the ones in the middle would come over to their side. That was the point, to eliminate the middle, to create a situation that would thrust everyone into one camp or the other, the fors and the against, with no room left in between for waffling or moderation. Radicalize was the term used by SDS, and in order to achieve that goal, they had to behave with the same stubbornness as the administration and never give an inch. There was intransigence on both sides then. But because the students were powerless at Columbia, SDS's intransigence came across as a strength, while the intransigence of the administration, which held all the power, came across as a weakness. SDS was goading Kirk into using force to clear the buildings, which was the one thing everyone else wanted to avoid. But the spectacle of hundreds of policemen storming the campus was also the one thing that was bound to provoke horror and disgust in the ones who were still in the middle and turn them to the students' cause. And the dumb administration, which turned out to be even dumber than Ferguson had supposed, as dumb as the Tsar of Russia, as dumb as the King of France, fell right into the trap. The administration stuck to its hard line because Kirk saw Columbia as a model for all other universities in the country. And if he caved in to the students' preposterous demands, what would happen elsewhere? It was the domino theory writ small, the same theory that had put 500,000 American soldiers in Vietnam. But as Ferguson had discovered in his first days of living in New York, dominoes was a game played on milk crates and folding tables by Puerto Ricans on the sidewalks of Spanish Harlem, and had nothing to do with politics or the running of universities. SDS, on the other hand, was making it up as it went along. Every day was packed with unexpected developments. Every hour felt as long as a day. And to do what had to be done required absolute concentration, as well as an openness of spirit found only in the best jazz musicians. As head of SDS, Mark Rudd became that jazz man, and the longer the occupation of the buildings went on, the more impressed Ferguson was by how fluidly Rudd adapted to each new circumstance, by how quickly he could think on his feet, by his willingness to talk about alternative approaches to each crisis as it came up. Kirk was rigid, but Rudd was loose and often playful. Kirk was a military band leader conducting John Philip Sousa numbers, but Rudd was on stage doing bebop with Charlie Parker. And Ferguson doubted that anyone else from SDS could have done a better job as spokesman for the group. By the night of April 23rd, Ferguson had already forgiven Mark for the Dear Grayson motherfucker fuck-up, which, by the by, had not offended people in the way he had thought it would. Student people, that is, pro-SDS and anti-administration students, which in turn had led Ferguson to ask himself what he knew about such things anyway. For not only had the words not offended people, they had become one of the rallying cries of the movement. It wasn't that Ferguson felt happy when he heard masses of students shouting out the phrase, "Up against the wall, motherfucker." But it was clear to him that Mark had a better sense of what was going on than he did, which explained why Rudd was leading a revolution, and Ferguson was only watching it and writing about it. Swarms of people on the campus at all hours, even in the middle of the night, round-the-clock swarms for an entire week, then intermittent swarms during the month that followed. And whenever Ferguson thought about that time later, the chaos that began on April 23rd and lasted until commencement day on June 4th, the swarms were always what came back to him first. Swarms of students and professors wearing different colored armbands, white ones for the faculty who were trying to keep the peace, red ones for the radicals, green ones for the supporters of the radicals and the six demands, and blue ones for the jocks and right-wingers, who had named themselves the Majority Coalition and held angry, clamorous demonstrations to denounce the other demonstrations, launched an attack on Fairweather Hall one night to evict the occupiers. They were repulsed after much pushing and shoving, and formed a successful blockade around Lowe on the final day of the sit-ins to prevent food from entering the building, which led to more shoving and punching and some bleeding scalps. As might have been expected from a University of Columbia's size, 17,500 students, counting all graduate and undergraduate divisions, the faculty was split into numerous factions, ranging from full support of the administration to full support of the students. Various suggestions were put forward, various committees were formed, a new approach to disciplinary procedures, for example, the Tripartite Commission, which advocated combined adjudication by equal numbers from the administration, faculty, and student body, and the Bipartite Commission, which advocated a panel of faculty and students only, with no members from the administration. But the most active committee was the one that called itself the Ad Hoc Faculty Group, which was largely composed of younger professors who held long and frantic meetings over the next days searching for a peaceful solution that would give the students most of what they wanted and get them out of the buildings without having to call in the police. All of their efforts failed. It wasn't that they didn't come up with some good ideas, but every one of those ideas was blocked by the administration, which refused to compromise or back down on any of the demands concerning discipline. And thus, the faculty learned that they were just as powerless as the students were, that Columbia was a dictatorship, mostly benevolent until now, but veering ever closer to absolutism, with no interest in reforming itself into anything that resembled a democracy. Students came and went, after all. Faculty came and went. But the administration and the Board of Trustees were eternal. Columbia wouldn't hesitate to call in the cops to drag the white students out of the buildings if necessary. But the black students in Hamilton Hall posed a more delicate and potentially more dangerous problem. If the police attacked them or handled them roughly while they were being arrested, the spectacle of white-on-black brutality could ignite the people of Harlem and send them rushing onto the campus in retaliation. And then Columbia would find itself at war with a vengeful black mob intent on ripping apart the university and burning Low Library to the ground. Given the anger in Harlem following Martin Luther King's murder, violence and destruction on such a massive scale was more than just an irrational fear, it was a distinct possibility. A police action to expel the trespassers in the five buildings was planned for the night of the 25th, 26th, the same night Mathematics Hall was taken. But when undercover plainclothesmen started banging their nightsticks on the heads of the white armband professors gathered in front of Lowe to protect the demonstrators inside, Columbia backed off and canceled the operation. If this was what the tactical patrol force could do against the whites, what were they not prepared to do against the blacks? The administration needed more time to negotiate with the SAS leaders in Hamilton, so its faculty emissaries could work out a separate peace that would spare the university from a Harlem invasion. As for the white students, the general feeling in the Spectator office was that SDS had already gained the upper hand on the two most important issues that had launched the protest, for it was almost certain now that the university would detach itself from IDA and the gymnasium would never be built. The students in the occupied buildings could have walked out unharmed at that point and declared victory. But the four other demands were still on the table, and SDS refused to budge until all of them had been met. The most controversial item was the one about amnesty, that a general amnesty be granted to the students participating in this demonstration, which turned out to be something of a conundrum for most people on campus, even members of the Spectator staff who were almost unanimously sympathetic to the occupiers in the buildings. For if, as SDS was claiming, the university was an illegitimate authority that had no right to punish them, how could they expect that same illegitimate authority to exonerate the protesters for what they were doing? As Mulhouse jokingly put it to Ferguson one afternoon in his pretend cowboy twang, "It's a real doggone little head-scratcher, ain't it, Arch?" Ferguson scratched his head in response and smiled. "You're damned right it is," he said, "and unless I'm mistaken, that's precisely what they want it to be. Their reasoning is absurd, but by holding out on a point they know they can't possibly win, they force the administration's hand." "To do what?" Mulhouse asked. "To call in the cops." "You can't be serious. Nobody can be that cynical." "It's not cynicism, Greg. It's strategy." Whether Ferguson was right or wrong, the cops were eventually called in at the close of the seventh day of the occupations. And at 2:30 in the morning on April 30th, an hour, as someone pointed out, when Harlem was asleep, the bust began. 1,000 helmeted troops from the New York City Riot Police fanned out across the campus as 1,000 onlookers stood in the chill and the damp of that eeriest of all black nights, while others swarmed and howled and chanted, "No violence," at the police, and the blue bands cheered them on, and the white bands and the green bands tried to block the TPF from entering the buildings. And the first thing Ferguson noticed was the animosity that existed between the police and the students, a mutual resentment that had nothing to do with the white-black antagonisms everyone had feared, but white-white class hatred, the privileged students and the bottom-rung cops, who saw the Columbia boys and girls as rich, spoiled, anti-American hippie brats, and the professors who supported them were no better, pompous anti-war intellectual radicals, Reds, the rancid poisoners of young minds. So first they took care of evacuating Hamilton and getting the blacks out as smoothly as they could. And because there was no resistance from the proud, tightly organized students of Malcolm X University, who had voted not to resist and calmly let the police escort them through the tunnels under the building to the paddy wagons that were parked outside, not one punch was thrown at them, not one nightstick cracked down on any of their skulls, and Columbia, through no efforts of its own, managed to escape the wrath of Harlem. By then, the water supply to the other buildings had been shut off, and one by one, the TPF and their plainclothes undercover men set about clearing Avery, Lowe, Fairweather, and Math, where the occupying students were hurriedly reinforcing the barricades they had erected behind the doors. But each building had its own battalion of white bands and green bands in front of it, and they were the ones who got the worst of the pounding, the ones who were clubbed and punched and kicked, as the cops plowed through them with crowbars to force open the locks and then charge in to bust up the barricades and arrest the students inside. No, it wasn't Newark, Ferguson kept telling himself as he watched the police go about their business. No shots were being fired, and therefore no one was going to be killed. But just because it wasn't as bad as Newark didn't mean it wasn't grotesque, for there was Alexander Platt, associate dean of the college, being punched in the chest by a cop. And there was philosopher Sidney Morkenbesser, he of the white sneakers and unraveling sweaters, and singing ontological quips, being banged over the head by a nightstick as he stood guard at the back entrance of Fairweather Hall. And there was a young reporter from the New York Times, Robert McGee Thomas Jr., showing his press card as he mounted the stairs in Avery Hall and being ordered to quit the building, at which point he was slugged in the head by a cop using a pair of handcuffs as brass knuckles, then shoved down the stairs and hit with a dozen billy clubs as he tumbled to the bottom. And there was Steve Shapiro, a photographer from Life magazine, being punched in the eye by one cop as another cop smashed his camera. And there was a doctor from the volunteer first aid crew, dressed in doctor's whites, being thrown to the ground, kicked, and dragged off to a paddy wagon. And there were dozens of male and female students being jumped by plainclothesmen hiding in the bushes and having their heads and faces clunked by saps, sticks, and pistol butts. Dozens of students stumbling around with blood pouring from their scalps and foreheads and eyebrows, and then after all the demonstrators in the buildings had been pulled out and carted away, a phalanx of TPF warriors began systematically moving back and forth across South Field to clear the campus of the hundreds who remained, charging into crowds of defenseless students and pummeling them to the ground. And there were the mounted police on Broadway, going at full gallop after the lucky ones who had eluded the clubs in the campus assault. And there was Ferguson, trying to do his job as reporter for his humble student rag, being hit on the back of the head by a billy club wielded by yet another undercover man dressed to look like a student, the same head that had been stitched up in 11 places 4.5 years earlier. And as Ferguson fell to the ground from the impact of the blow, someone else stomped on his left hand with the heel of a boot or a shoe, the same hand that was already missing its thumb and 2/3 of its index finger. And when the foot came down on him, Ferguson felt the hand must have been broken, which turned out not to be true. But how it hurt, and how quickly it swelled up afterward, and how much, from that moment on, he came to despise cops. 720 people arrested. Nearly 150 injuries reported, with untold numbers of unreported injuries as well, among them the knocks that had been delivered to Ferguson's head and hand. The editorial and that day's Spectator had no words in it, just the masthead followed by two blank columns, bordered in black. Spring 1968, 5. On Saturday, May 4th, Ferguson and Amy finally sat down and talked. Ferguson was the one who insisted on it, and he made it clear to her that he didn't want it to be a conversation about his wounds or Amy's arrest with her fellow occupiers in Lowe. Nor were they going to discuss the general strike against Columbia that had been declared on the evening of April 30th by a coalition of red bands, green bands, and moderates. The SDS strategy had worked. Or dwell for a single moment on the big things that were starting to happen in their adored, fiercely remembered Paris. No, he said, for one night, they would forget about politics and talk about themselves. And Amy reluctantly gave in, even though she could think about little else but the movement now. What she called the euphoria of the struggle and the electric awakening that had transformed her after 6 days of communal living in Lowe. In order to avoid a potential shouting match in the apartment, Ferguson suggested they go to a neutral site, a public site, where the presence of strangers would stop them from losing control of themselves. And because they hadn't been to the Green Tree in over 2 months, they decided to return to Yum City for what Ferguson supposed would be the last meal they ever had together for the rest of their lives. How happy Mr. and Mrs. Molnar were to see their favorite young couple walk through the door of the restaurant, and how accommodating they were when Ferguson asked for a rear corner table in the back room, the smaller, slightly elevated room that had fewer tables in it, and how kind they were to offer them a free bottle of Bordeaux to accompany their dinner, and how miserable Ferguson felt as he and Amy sat down for their last supper of all time, noting how perfectly apt it was that Amy should instinctively choose to sit in the chair with her back against the wall, meaning that she could look out and see the other people in the restaurant, while Ferguson instinctively sat down in the chair with his back to those people, meaning that the only person he could see was Amy and the wall behind her. For that was who they were, he said to himself. That was who they had always been for the past 4 years and 8 months. Amy looking out at others, and he looking only at Amy. They spent an hour and a half there, perhaps an hour and three quarters. He was never sure exactly how long it was. And as the normally ravenous Amy picked at her food, and Ferguson downed glass after glass of red wine, polishing off most of the first bottle himself and then ordering another, they talked and fell silent again, and then talked and talked and talked. And soon enough, Ferguson was being told they were finished, that they had outgrown each other and were moving in different directions now, and therefore would have to stop living together. And no, Amy said, it wasn't anyone's fault, least of all Ferguson's fault, he who had loved her so hard and so well since their first kiss on the bench in that little Montclair park. No, it was simply that she could no longer bear the smothering confines of couplehood. She had to be free to push on alone, to go out to California unattached and unencumbered by anyone or anything, and continue working for the movement. That was her life now, and Ferguson had no place in it anymore. Her wonderful Archie, of the big soul and kind heart, would have to get along without her, and she was sorry, so immensely sorry, but that's the way it was now, and nothing, not one thing in the whole wide world, could ever make it different. Amy was crying by then. Two streams of tears were falling down her face as she gently crucified the son of Rose and Stanley Ferguson. But Ferguson himself, who had far more reason to cry than she did, was too drunk to cry. Not excessively drunk, but drunk enough to feel no impulse to open the saltwater spigots, which was a fortunate thing, he felt, since he didn't want her last impression of him to be that of a destroyed man weeping his guts out in front of her. And therefore he summoned every bit of the strength he still had in him and said, "Oh, my best beloved Amy, my extraordinary Amy of the wild hair and shining eyes, my darling lover of a thousand transcended naked nights, my brilliant girl whose mouth and body have done such wondrous things to my mouth and body over the years, the only girl who has ever slept with me, the only girl I have ever wanted to sleep with. Not only am I going to miss your body every day for the rest of my life, but I will especially miss those parts of your body that belong only to me, that belong to my eyes and my hands and are not even known to you by yourself, the parts of you that you have never seen, the back parts that are invisible to you, just as mine are to me, just as they are to each person who has a body of his or her own, beginning with your ass, of course, your deliciously round and shapely ass, and the backs of your legs with the little brown dots on them that I have worshipped for so long, and the lines engraved in your skin just behind your knees in the place where the legs bend. How I have marveled at the beauty of those two lines, and then the hidden half of your neck and the bumps in your spine when you lean over, and the lovely curve in the small of your back, which have belonged to me and only to me for all these years, and most of all your shoulder blades, darling Amy, the jut of your two shoulder blades, which have always reminded me of swan's wings, or the wings jutting from the back of the White Rock Seltzer girl, who was the first girl I ever loved. Please, Archie, Amy said, please stop. But I haven't finished. No, Archie, please, I can't take it. Ferguson was about to speak again, but before he could get his tongue into the proper position, Amy stood up from her chair, wiped away her tears with a napkin, and walked out of the restaurant. May, June, 1968. The next morning, Amy packed up her things, deposited them with her parents on West 75th Street, and then spent her last month as a Barnard undergraduate camped out on the sofa in the living room of Patsy Dugan's apartment on Claremont Avenue. Ferguson was more than exhausted now, more than numb. He was back in the dark dormitory elevator of the 1965 blackout, which could no longer be distinguished from the 1946-47 blackout when he was still in his mother's womb. He was 21 years old, and if he meant to have any kind of life in the future, he would have to be born all over again, a yowling neonate pulled from the darkness for another chance to find his way in the glare and shimmer of the world. On May 13th, 1 million people marched through the streets of Paris. The whole country of France was in revolt, and where in God's name had de Gaulle gone to? One placard read, Columbia, Paris. On the 21st, Hamilton Hall was occupied for a second time, and 138 people were arrested. That night, the battle on the Columbia campus between cops and students was bigger, bloodier, and even more savage than the one on the night of the 700-person bust. After the May 22nd issue, the Spectator ceased publication until the final issue of the semester on June 3rd. That same day, Ferguson left New York to spend a month with his parents in Florida. While he was in the air heading south, Andy Warhol was shot and almost killed by a woman named Valerie Solanas, who had written a manifesto entitled Scum, Society for Cutting Up Men, and a play called Up Your Ass. 2 days after that, Robert Kennedy was shot in Los Angeles by a man named Sirhan Sirhan, and killed at the age of 42. Ferguson walked on the beach every evening at dusk, played tennis with his father on most mornings, ate lox and eggs at Wolfie's in honor of his grandmother, and spent the bulk of his time in the air-conditioned department working on his translations of French poems. On June 16th, not knowing where Amy was anymore, he sealed up one of those poems in an envelope and sent it off to her in care of her parents in New York. He couldn't write her a letter, and wouldn't write her a letter, but the poem somehow managed to say most of the things he himself could no longer say to her. The Pretty Redhead by Guillaume Apollinaire. I stand here before you a man full of sense, knowing life and as much of death as a living person can know, having tasted the sorrow and joys of love, having known at times how to get across his ideas, knowing several languages, having done his fair share of traveling, having seen war in the artillery and the infantry, wounded in the head, trepanned under chloroform, having lost his best friends in the nightmare of battle. I know as much as one man can know of both the ancient and the new. And without bothering myself about this war today, between us and for us, my friends, I judge this long quarrel between tradition and imagination as a dispute between order and adventure. You whose mouth is made in the image of God's mouth, a mouth that is order itself, Be gentle when you compare us to those who are the perfection of order, we who are looking for adventure everywhere. We are not your enemies. We want to give you vast and strange kingdoms where the flowers of mystery are there for anyone to pluck. In those places there are new fires, colors never seen, the chaos of a thousand optical illusions which must be made real. We want to explore kindness, the enormous country where everything is silent, as well as time which can be chased away or summoned back. Pity for us who are always fighting at the frontiers of boundlessness and the future. Pity our mistakes. Pity our sins. Now summer is upon us, the violent season, and my youth is as dead as the spring. O sun, this is a time of burning reason, and I am waiting to follow the sweet and noble form she always takes so I alone can love her. She comes and draws me to her as iron filings to a magnet. She has the charming look of an adorable redhead. Her hair is made of gold, it would seem, a beautiful flash of lightning that flashes on and on and on, or those flames that waltz around in wilting tea roses. But laugh, laugh at me, men from around the world, especially people from here, for there are so many things I don't dare tell you, so many things you wouldn't let me say. Have pity on me. Translated by A.I. Ferguson.